Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think of your goals. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If you want to learn a new language, you absolutely should get Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I absolutely love Babbel because their courses help me learn real-life conversational skills. It's so easy to learn how to order food, ask for directions, speak to the locals without having to consult language apps. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time offer for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/SPP. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/SPP. That's spelled BABBEL.com/SPP. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The podcast where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people.
That is an awesome question.
This one goes down probably on one of my top five.
Hey, I like nutrition. I like to eat food.
This is the coolest thing ever. We're going to do this forever.
I wish I paid more attention in that class.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't understand that. As a man, I don't get it.
Welcome to SmartPeoplePodcast.com.
Hello and welcome to Smart People Podcast, conversations that satisfy your curious mind. Chris Stemp here, and thank you as always for joining us. Who do we have in store for you today? Well, today we are speaking with New York Times bestselling author Paul Tough. Paul's bestselling book, How Children Succeed, first introduced readers to the research that shows that character strengths like grit, perseverance, self-control, and optimism play a critical and often overlooked role in children's success. But after that book came out, Tough spent months on the road speaking to teachers and community groups, and after each talk, he'd often get the same question, which is, okay, I get this, but what do we do about it? Well, Paul decided it's time for a follow-up book, an action-oriented book. So instead of just knowing how children succeed, we can actually help children succeed. And that just so happens to be the name of his brand new book, Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. So look, if you've been listening to the show with any consistency, you know at this point I have a 15-month-old son. He's like 14 and a half months, but I'm not going to split hairs here. But so of course I was excited to talk to Paul, but I know many of you out there, young kids, maybe older kids, maybe your grandparents and you want to be the know-it-all. Look, there's something in here for everyone. So what do we talk about? Well, in this episode, we're talking about what children need in order to thrive, but also what kind of practices and policies in the home and at school will provide them with the best possible chance at success. Fascinating subject. Great work. I'm so happy we could have Paul on and share that with you all. As I mentioned, so Paul is an author, previous best-selling book, was translated into 27 languages, and spent more than a year on the New York Times bestseller list. His first book was Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America, and that was published in 2008. He's a writer at the New York Times Magazine, where he's written extensively about education, parenting, poverty, and politics. His writing has also appeared in The New Yorker, Atlantic, GQ, and Esquire. Previously, Paul was a reporter and producer for the public radio program This American Life, which some of you may have heard of. All right, going to turn it over here to Paul in a minute. A few things I wanted to let you know. We will not have an episode on July 4th due to the holiday, so make sure you go ahead and download any of those back catalogs that you wanted to listen to for your July 4th trip. And also, don't forget to sign up on the newsletter where even if we're off, we're on. So go to smartpeoplepodcast.com, bottom right-hand corner. You can sign up there and be on the insider's track. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes so you never miss an episode. Going to turn it over now to Paul Tough as we discuss his newest book, Helping Children Succeed. So I'm assuming, and I don't know if it's fair to assume here, but is the reason you went down this whole path of writing about children and children succeeding due to your own growing family, or was there some other impetus behind that?
I think it's related, but no, I don't think that was the original impetus, because, you know, I really started writing about children and education more than a decade ago, and my oldest child is just about to turn 7. So it all started for me with a book that I wrote, which came out of an article that I wrote back in 2004 about the Harlem Children's Zone and Jeffrey Canada, the man who ran it. And that kind of led to my second book, which led to my third book. And along the way, had kids, and that certainly deepened my interest and expanded my understanding of what I was writing about. But it started as a more purely journalistic project.
So, okay, I got you. So you took on that first project, and then kind of from there, you said, wait, there's some traction, I'm enjoying this, and then went on to the How Children Succeed book. Is that right?
Exactly. And so when I started How Children Succeed, it was almost exactly the time when my first son, Ellington, was born. And so that one felt much more tied up in trying to find the balance between, you know, doing sort of pure reporting and reading research and visiting schools and doing sort of that kind of straight journalism, and also reflecting on my own experience raising my, at that point, just one son.
Right, right. And so I want to touch on, you know, because How Children Succeed, the book really behind this newest one, Helping Children Succeed, was the foundation. And I want to give some time there. So we first learn, I think the core is what are the traits and the things that parents, or I guess that comes more, but what are the traits that kids have in order to be successful?
So the my previous book, How Children Succeed, drew on this emerging body of research coming out of economics and neuroscience and psychology, as well as education, that showed that the kind of cognitive skills, that narrow band of cognitive skills that get measured on standardized tests, did that those skills on their own and the tests, the numbers that they were reflected in those tests, they didn't capture all of what was important in children's success. Both there were kids who were succeeding without necessarily having high test scores, and there were kids who had high test scores who weren't succeeding. This was starting, I think, about a decade ago, all this research started coming together to suggest that there was this other set of qualities that people had, and especially children had, sometimes called non-cognitive skills, sometimes called character strengths, that seemed like they were important in children's success. And so How Children Succeed was trying to look at what was then a pretty new body of research and try to figure out, well, what are these skills? How are they built? Where do they come from? And so the kind of qualities that these researchers were talking about included things like grit and curiosity, perseverance, conscientiousness, self-control, optimism.
So as we talk about things like resilience and grit and perseverance, how much of it is nature versus nurture? I've always wondered that, especially having a son of my own. I spend so much time thinking, like, how can I do it all right? And I just see already his personality is going to come through regardless of what I do in some circumstances.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, some of it is definitely nature. There's a genetic component to everything about who we are. But I emphasize in both of these books, in both How Children Succeed and Helping Children Succeed, the nurture side. I don't think anyone knows what the exact division is between nature and nurture, and I think it's different for different kids in different environments. But I think the important message for parents, and then more broadly for policymakers, is that the environment that kids grow up in has a huge effect on their development, and particularly the development of these so-called non-cognitive skills. and that the elements in the environment that matter the most are about their relationships, the relationships that they have, especially with their parents, but with other adults in their lives. And so, you know, I do think that parents can take it too far and feel like, oh, everything, you know, I have complete control over what this child is going to be like. And if things aren't working out perfectly, I must have done something wrong. And so I think it's worth guarding against that. But on the whole, I think that there is a lot that we do as parents that affects how our kids develop. It's just not always, you know, it's not always a clear cause and effect. In other words, children, like all of us, are irrational beings. And so we don't shape them just by, like, you know, telling them to do certain things and then they do those things. As you know, it doesn't always work out that way.
Right.
But that said, I think there's a lot that's going on in terms of the environment that parents create in the home, the messages, the sort of psychological messages that we send, both explicitly and implicitly. What the research suggests is that that does a lot to shape how kids develop, especially in this character dimension.
So how does it differ when you were talking about how children succeed versus helping them succeed?
So, well, so these two books are, as you said, they're definitely related, but they are, they're separate as well. So how children succeed was, but one of the ways they're different is just in the way that I wrote them. So How Children Succeed is more of a work of narrative nonfiction, meaning that I took a lot of characters, some children, some educators, a pediatrician, mentors, different families, and wrote about their stories as ways to illuminate this research. And so there's a sort of long tradition in journalism of this narrative long-form nonfiction, and there's a lot about it that is, I think, appealing to readers. But it is also, you know, if you are an educator or a parent or a mentor and you're actually looking for answers to the question of, like, what do I do in the classroom? How do I help these young people who I'm responsible for to succeed? Those stories don't always give you clear answers. And so that was what I was hearing from lots of readers after that, after How Children Succeed came out. They wanted to know, what do we do? If all this science is true, what do we actually do? And so Helping Children Succeed is my attempt to answer that question. It is a more practical set of strategies and ideas that I'm hoping that parents, teachers, educators, and those of us who are trying to shape policy to create environments that surround children can use to actually affect what we do every day.
Right. Now, that makes complete sense. And my wife is a kindergarten teacher. And I mean, listening to her and listening to the differences in personalities, the way kids react, and then the job of specifically a kindergarten teacher to be able to maneuver and understand, this is how I have to approach it with this child, this is how I have to approach it with this child, really goes to show that I'm sure you came up with, there's a number of different ways to help the individual as opposed to probably prescribing one thing for all.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the many reasons that the job of a teacher is so complicated is that, yeah, on the one hand, you know, I think there are certain principles that we want teachers to understand. And part of what I'm trying to, I mean, I think every teacher has their own intuitions, but I think they're also, you know, learning constantly in graduate school and in professional development about how kids develop and what the right approach is to help steer them in the right direction. But it's one of the things that I'm trying to do in this book as well, is to give teachers specifically, like your wife, this grounding in the science of brain development and character development, personality development, how children's environments shape them, in order to give them some principles, some ideas, some strategies of what to do differently in the classroom. But that said, you know, I think you're absolutely right that while these principles, I hope anyway, are helpful, there's also inevitably a lot of improvisation involved when you're a teacher. No rule sort of works perfectly for every kid. And that's probably more true in kindergarten than in any other time.
I want to get into some of the nuts and bolts of it. But first, I still want to go back a little bit. Let's talk about the research in how they succeed. Was that things like the marshmallow study that I've heard about, where they put kids in a room with basically marshmallows and told them not to eat them? Is that kind of the research you were looking at?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I wrote about in How Children Succeed. That was kind of one of the early indications that there was something going on in these personality traits that children had. They're, you know, something as random as whether they would grab a second marshmallow or be able to delay gratification and control those impulses. The researchers were discovering that those small personality traits and habits in childhood corresponded with different sorts of outcomes in later childhood and in adulthood. So the marshmallow test was sort of the most vivid one because of, you know, anything involving marshmallows is vivid. Mm-hmm. But there was a bigger study done by some researchers in New Zealand that tracked children, a whole cohort of children from birth all the way into adulthood. And it, in a much more sort of reliable scientific way, showed that how kids were rated in childhood, in I think in early elementary school, on things like their conscientiousness, corresponded with all sorts of outcomes in early adulthood, like how much they were earning, whether they were employed, whether they had run into, you know, money trouble, whether they had had trouble with the law, whether they had gotten married and stayed married. And so I think what all this research suggested to people, whether it's with marshmallows or anything else, is that you know, all these things that seem like they're just little personality traits and habits that kids have, these really matter. And in most of our, mostly in our education system, we're very focused on intellectual traits. You know, we think like if you're a kindergarten teacher, like your wife, the pressure on you right now from above is to help students succeed in math and reading. And you are your ability to accomplish your job is assessed based mostly on how well your students are doing in math and reading. And so what all of this research that I wrote about and how children succeed, I think, is pushing us toward is realizing that actually there's a lot of other things going on in child development and in education, and that if we want to have teachers help students succeed in the most profound way, they need to be aware of this research and directing their pedagogy, what they do in the classroom, toward helping kids develop perseverance and self-control and optimism and curiosity, as well as the ability to read and write and do math.
And that brings me to this question of, do you think we're going the wrong way or have been going the wrong way in regarding the way we raise our kids? Because a lot of the character traits that you speak of, I think, have been almost guarded out of children. You know, I remember reading a study about how I think the time spent in free play and recess in America is just continuing to go down. And in other countries, it's much larger. And the impact that has on the growth of a young child. And I think in the past, parents might not have had the ability to be helicopter parents as much. They let their children learn these lessons the harder way. Do you think we've been going backwards, or we're just being more well-versed on what's right and what we should do?
I think there are some things that have been happening both in education and in parenting over the past 10, 20 years that have been detrimental to kids. So in some ways, I think, yes, we have been going in the wrong direction. I mean, in other important ways, I think we've been going in the right direction. But I'll talk about it in two ways. I mean, so in terms of education, there has been this big push over the last 15, 16 years on the federal level and down at the state and local level as well, to focus all of our attention on standardized tests and the kind of skills that are measured on those tests. And so I think that has really shaped a lot about how schools function in a few ways. I mean, one is just literally it's meant that teachers have spent more of their time focused on this narrow set of skills and not on the broader set of abilities that children need. But I think it's also created a level of anxiety in the classroom, and especially in schools that serve a lot of low-income kids, where there's often a lot of stress for these kids already in their homes and in their communities. The fact that so much of the pressure of these federal laws has been on those schools and the need for them to improve their test scores, I think that it has created this kind of anxiety for a lot of teachers, a lot of administrators, and that trickles down to students in ways that are often really counterproductive. At the same time, I think in the home there has been this new sense, especially among more affluent parents, this new sense of sort of competitive anxiety, this real pressure for kids to succeed in what I consider to be a pretty narrow way that there's more anxiety about test scores, about accomplishments, about, you know, college admissions. And again, I think that puts a lot of pressure on students. And so there's a lot of data out there about how children are more stressed out. They do have less freedom, less autonomy, less free time, less unstructured time, less time for play. And that all, you know, the science is pretty clear that that can be really detrimental to them. And then at the same time, they have this pressure on them that kids in the past, I don't think, felt as acutely to sort of fulfill their parents' destiny and their family's destiny by how well they do in school. And what I think common sense tells us, but also the research tells us, is that that can be really detrimental to children's development when they feel a lot of external pressure. It stresses them out, first of all, but it also takes away from their own intrinsic motivation. So kids, even kids who like school, are often less motivated to learn and more motivated simply by checking off the right boxes and getting the right numbers.
All right, so let's take that child who was more motivated to get the right numbers. And let's just say for conversation, you know, purposes, that child was me. Like, here's the thing. Okay, I was being facetious, obviously, to everyone. But, you know, school was always really easy for me, but it was because I knew how to do what was asked, either what was obviously asked or what was implied. And then I really feel like I never explored my own curiosity until well after school, when I realized, like, wow, nobody's telling me what to learn. What do I find interesting? How do we get that out of not just the school system, but our own mentality as parents or mentors or leaders? How do we influence them to think more for themselves or do it for their own purposes?
I mean, I think it's a big shift for a lot of parents and a lot of educators, and then for a lot of kids as well. The good news, I think, is that children are naturally are natural learners. You know, they're curious. They are they persevere. When there's something that they're interested in, you know, I see this in my 16-month-old, but I certainly also see it in my almost 7-year-old. When there's something that they're interested in, whether it's Fisher-Price basketball or Minecraft or anything in between, they will get incredibly engaged in it and push themselves as learners in all sorts of amazing to watch ways. And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of what we do as parents and as teachers that takes them away from that. We don't give them as much freedom and room and sort of respect for their curiosity as would be ideal. And there's a lot about how we push kids when we push them using kind of behaviorist techniques with incentives and disincentives, when we help them equate learning with the result of learning, you know, a number or a reward or a sticker of some kind, rather than just the experience of learning. That is, you know, that really takes them away from what I think kids naturally have, which is just like learning is actually fun. And I think there aren't a lot of kids in your average school who would say that. But I think every child, when they're your kid's age or my kid's age, they know that learning is fun. That's all they do every day, is try and learn new things. So on the one hand, I think that the good news is that we can help kids by just doing a little bit less. but I think that actually is a real challenge, I think, for a lot of parents. Just giving kids the sort of space and opportunity and resources to learn and to explore their curiosity, that's a big shift, I think, for a lot of parents.
For some reason, I just had this idea. I don't know what. It was like a visual. I tend to think of visuals of, you know, you can either think of it as your child is the train and you're putting them on a track, right? So it just can follow this track. And you tell me what you think. Or it's like a bowling lane and you can just be the bumpers. So they're going to kind of go back and forth, but eventually they'll get there and knock down some pins.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know why that just occurred to me.
I like it. I mean, the only way that I would sort of expand your metaphor a little bit, I like your bowling metaphor, is that, you know, that I think that sometimes you don't even want to have the bumpers there, you know, like sometimes you want your kids to roll a gutter ball. and I think that that's another place where parents get particularly anxious, that they don't want their kids to fail. And obviously in the big picture, of course, we don't want our kids to, you know, to have bad lives. But I think that impulse in a lot of parents extends to not letting them have any moments of failure, that any setbacks, any, you know, bad grades, any mistakes are cause for sort of anxiety on our part, right? Which obviously then is communicated to our kids on a deep kind of level. And in fact, what the research suggests, especially that I wrote about in How Children Succeed, is that those moments of failure, of setbacks, of struggling and then overcoming that struggle, those are incredibly important moments in the development of these character strengths like grit and self-control and conscientiousness. That having those moments, being allowed to have those moments of failure and learning from them is the most important way that we learn. And I think there is a lot in the way that we organize our schools and that I think a lot of families are functioning as well that pushes kids away from feeling that they can fail and that they can learn from their failures when they do fail.
This week's episode is brought to you by The Great Courses. Like so many of you, our love of learning didn't stop when we finished school. That's why we're excited about the new Great Courses Plus video learning service. You'll get unlimited access to thousands of The Great Courses online lectures on so many topics taught by top professors. We really want you to try The Great Courses Plus, so they're giving our listeners a special chance to watch hundreds of their courses for free, including the course we just watched, Fundamentals of Photography. Fundamentals of Photography, taught by professional photographer and National Geographic fellow Joel Satori, gives you tools and techniques to take better pictures. This course has exactly what you're looking for. If you're looking for advice on lighting, framing, perspectives, it's all here. Check it out today, Fundamentals of Photography. At Smart People Podcast, we're big fans of The Great Courses Plus, and we want you to try it too. As a Smart People Podcast listener, when you sign up, you'll immediately get 1 month free to start any lectures you want. Here's how you do it. Start your free trial today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/smartpeople. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smartpeople. And now back to the episode.
Yeah, I just saw this video on Facebook. It was D'Angelo Williams, NFL football player. And he was talking about how his daughter was doing these races, and her first race, she got like fifth place or something. And she came back and said, "Hey dad, I got this participation trophy." And he said, "Go give it back." And she was like, "Why?" And he was like, "'Cause you didn't earn it." And then she won like the next three races. And, you know, look, who knows? It's just a story behind it all. But I think there's a lot of truth behind, you know, look, you got to earn it. And if you think you just get it handed to you, that's what's gotten us into a lot of trouble. But I feel like that's not something that most people at this stage, I feel like we get that. You know what I mean? Like, have you found that mentality of let them fail is becoming more mainstream now?
I think, saying that has become, I think the participation trophies, it's like, I feel like so many people have like made a case against participation trophies. I can't believe anyone gives them out anymore.
Right.
But I feel like in reality, what often happens in families, especially, you know, better off families, is that, the moments of like finding opportunities for challenge and struggle, that they happen in subtler ways, you know, that I think it has a lot to do with how we organize our kids' time, you know, like the activities that we choose for them versus how much we let them choose their own moments. You know, like when we're talking about moments of failure, it doesn't have to be in sort of an organized environment, you know, like losing a little league game or something like that. I think, you know, I think that's important. And I think the way that we organize our kids' sports is really important, and the messages that we send them matter a lot. But I think it's also important to remember that like those moments of struggle and challenge and failure come doing homework at night and, you know, setting the table and, you know, playing with your little brother and all of these kind of moments, how we talk to kids about whether it's okay to struggle and whether it's okay to have setbacks, I think I think that really matters. And how we talk to kids about the process of getting better at things, I think matters as well. I think there's a lot in how we, I mean, it almost sort of goes without saying, right? Like in sports or in anything else, a lot of how childhood works, I think, is that we try to find what our kids are good at and push them in that direction, right? In some ways, of course, that's just what you do. But there's something about that that I think takes away from the experience of like, it's kind of good to be the worst kid on your basketball team and because you really love basketball. And instead of like, let's switch you to a sport that you're better at, even if you're not particularly excited about it, let's have that experience of like being the kid who struggles and has to work harder than everybody else. And I think for especially in well-off families, being that person who is the person who is, you know, doing something that they're not that good at and that they're struggling through is seen as sort of shameful. And I think that message gets sent to kids in dozens of different ways all the time. And when we can reverse that and say, like, actually, it's the kid who's struggling and trying to push themselves through difficulties that is that child is succeeding more than anyone else, I think that message gets really deep for kids, and it gives them permission to struggle, whether it's with a sport or more intellectual activity or, you know, just an interest.
You know, I that reminds me of, so in helping children succeed, there's a pretty big focus on poor families, poor kids.
Yes.
And as you kind of were just mentioning, you know, some differences with people or kids who grew up with money, right? With privilege. Why start with those that might not have a certain amount of material goods or even their basic needs met? And then, is it fair to translate some of that learning to those in different situations, perhaps the more affluent?
So in How Children Succeed, the book that came out a couple years ago, I talked about a broader range of kids. So there was a lot of reporting that happened in high poverty neighborhoods, but I also did a lot of reporting in independent schools and wrote about this, what I find to be pretty interesting research about affluence and how affluence tends to stress kids out almost as much as poverty does. But in Helping Children Succeed, I wanted to take on this very specific question of what it is in the lives of kids who are growing up with adversity, especially kids in poverty, how that adversity affects their development, and then what kind of interventions can help those kids succeed. And so in some ways I was narrowing my focus, but I think for a very specific reason, which is that I do think that the challenges that well-off kids face are important, and it's certainly important for parents to think about and for the educators who are educating those kids to think about it. But as a policy question, I feel like it's not a huge concern. Like, I feel like individual families can think that through and, you know, can read books like mine and change their practices and can really help their kids kind of on their own. But I think that kids who are growing up in poverty and other forms of adversity, they need more help. I mean, that's a big part of what public policy is and does and should do, is helps create systems of opportunity, resources that provide opportunity to children who are growing up without enough resources. And so that's why I set out to write this new book, to try to answer that question of what do we do, what can we do to help those kids succeed.
And do you think that there's a pretty good translation into those versus kind of the general population?
Yes and no. I mean, I think a lot. So a lot of the research that I draw on in Helping Children Succeed is research in neurobiology and how the brain develops, especially in early childhood, and how growing up in stressful environments, especially intensely stressful environments, what doctors sometimes call toxic stress, how that has a really detrimental effect on children's development. And there's data that shows that when kids are in poverty, especially in, you know, high poverty neighborhoods, they're more likely to be in really stressful environments for all kinds of obvious reasons. You know, I think life when you don't have a lot of money just is more stressful, and that stress often gets passed on to kids. But it's not, you know, it's not by any means a perfect correlation. There are a lot of kids who are growing up in poverty who actually have very stable, secure, calm home environments, and that that helps them succeed and develop well. And then there are kids who are growing up in affluence who actually have extremely stressful, unstable, chaotic environments at home, because they're often because their parents are mostly absent or are struggling with one issue or another. And in that case, money doesn't help very much. Being in that kind of stressful, chaotic environment is bad for kids, no matter how many other resources are around. So I do think that there's a lot about what parents do, both positively and negatively, to affect their children's development, especially as connects to this issue of stress, that is relevant for any parent to know. And it's certainly the research about what parents do in early childhood has affected me a lot as I've been trying to help raise my younger son over the last year and a half. But I do think that there, as a policy issue, this is something that is more specifically important for us to think about in terms of kids who are growing up in low-income homes.
Well, if there's one thing I know about our listeners and this show, we love learning about the brain. And I know you said you focus a lot on brain development. And in addition, I have this tugging question that I want to ask you about the stress. Being a fairly new father, and even by most accounts being, middle class or whatever, it's just there's inherent stress with a first child. And maybe second and third, I can only speak to the first, but... Yeah. So I'd like to spend, the good remainder of our time talking about what does the brain development of a child look like, essentially? And then as it relates to stress and what you can do in the home to foster a more well-balanced, well-rounded child, how do we do that? So first, let's start with brain development. Tell us what you found out there and what the research is saying now.
So I think all these things are connected. The brain develops best when in early childhood a child is in an environment of relationships that has a couple of elements. One is a sense of calm and stability and warmth when that child is, surrounded by not a lot of, loud, surprising, scary noises and sudden surprises. Those are scary for kids, understandably. But I think more importantly, when they're in a, what psychologists call a responsive relationship. So there's this phrase, serve and return parenting, that I read about in Helping Children Succeed. And neuroscientists and psychologists have discovered that serve and return parenting is really important in the development of children's brains, and especially in the development of these, the building blocks that underlie these non-cognitive skills or character strengths. And serve and return parenting is just the sort of moments of back and forth between a parent and a child where they're looking at each other, close, calm, and the baby indicates something, like babbles or points to something or does something cute, and the parent responds by saying, that's your little dolly, right? Or, oh, you're looking at the bird up in the sky. And those moments are important in a few ways. They're important in terms of vocabulary development. There are moments of talking back and forth that help kids develop their own vocabulary and develop their own speech. But more importantly, what psychologists are discovering is that they are moments where kids understand their place in the universe in important ways. Having just gone through the first year of your child's life, it often seems like the kids are just sort of barely getting through the day, like all they're thinking about is eating and sleeping and not much else is going on. But in fact, these babies are learning an enormous amount, right? And even though they're often not early on learning language, numbers, and the stuff that we think of as what's important in kindergarten, what they are learning is their place in the world. They're like who they are, who these giants surrounding them are, what they're able to expect from the world. And those little cues that mostly come through this sort of serve and return parenting give them these important messages. And when kids are in warm, responsive, calm, serve and return environments, they get the message that life is going to be okay, that they can, that they have people around them who are going to support them and help them and provide for them, that it's good to be curious about things, that if you open a box, something fun is going to be inside usually. And those are really like psychological messages. You know, it seems kind of crazy to talk about the psychology of a six-month-old, but absolutely our psychology is being built in those moments. And so there's this phenomenon that that psychologists talk about called secure attachment. And when children are in an environment, especially in the first year of life, where they feel this close, warm connection to a parent or a few parents, and when they feel security, when they feel this confidence that this person is going to be there when they need them, this has this enormous effect on how kids do later on. There's this study that I read about from a couple of psychologists in – suddenly I'm blanking on where that study's from – The Development of the Person is the name of the book. And it finds that when kids have this secure attachment in the first year of life, which you can measure through a variety of different tests, that correlates with kids in pre-K being more confident, more outgoing, more able to, you know, kind of entertain themselves and stick with tasks for longer periods of time. In middle school, it equates with kids who are more sort of socially adept and able to deal with different sorts of situations. And it even correlates with high school graduation rates. So, and all of that starts in the first year of life, in those little back and forth moments between parents and kids. And when children are not getting that kind of warm, responsive, serve and return, secure attachment care in the first year and first few years of life, it can have a really detrimental effect on their development. They're getting very different sorts of messages from their environment, the message that, you know, you can't really trust other people, that it's a dangerous world, it's a world full of trouble, and you need to prepare for that. And so those kids, they adapt in different ways that fires up their fight or flight response. They, you know, there are biological changes when you're in that kind of stressful environment. Your immune system gets amped up. Your stress response system, the presence of chemicals in your bloodstream like cortisol and adrenaline increase. And all of that affects how kids behave on the first day of kindergarten. And so certainly true for parents, but I think it's true as a policy question as well. If we want to help kids be in a position to learn and to thrive on that first day of kindergarten, there's a whole lot that we can do in the first few years of life, and especially the first year of life, but it's all about those little moments, those little back and forth moments between parents and children.
You know, I actually am in the middle of this book. It's called The Last Best Cure, and it's all about how you can use your thoughts and all these different things to heal your body, really. But specifically, the author talks about these things called ACEs, which are adverse childhood experiences. And I'm seeing the parallels so much. I'm wondering if have you ever come across that term in your research, or perhaps that book, or anything like that?
Yes. So the adverse childhood experiences study is something that I write about both in How Children Succeed and in Helping Children Succeed. I think it's a really important. It was very important, I think, in helping the field as a whole understand the importance of stress on children's development. And when kids are in traumatic situations, it affects their physical development and their mental development and their psychological development. The adverse childhood experience study on its own mostly measured the physical side of things. So this study found that when kids experienced a whole lot of adversity in childhood, especially as measured by traumatic events, as adults, they had heart disease rates that were twice as high as normal, and cancer rates that are twice as high as normal, and emphysema rates that are four times as high as normal. But what researchers have discovered more recently, and that I write about in Helping Children Succeed, is that there's also this effect through these stress pathways on children's mental abilities and their psychological development. And that plays out in school. So there's one study I read about that when children have experienced four or more ACEs, four or more of these sort of traumatic categories of traumatic experience, they are more than 50% likely to be kids who are labeled as having learning problems or having behavioral problems in school. And when they have zero ACEs, when they haven't experienced any real trauma in childhood, there's only a 3% chance that they are the kids who are labeled as behavioral or learning problems. So when you see those statistics, you know, and you're a kindergarten teacher like your wife, it really gives you a different perspective on what's going on in your classroom. It's certainly not a perfect correlation, but you know, I think any teacher sort of has this intuition as well, that the kids who are often struggling in kindergarten are ones who have difficult home lives, and often those home lives, the way that it affects kids' development is through these pathways of stress, and so I think there's a way to look at that data and interpret it the wrong way as saying like, well, kids who come from these difficult backgrounds, they just can't succeed. They're doomed. They are, you know, sort of their brain damaged. And actually that's not at all what the research is suggesting, but it is suggesting that these kids have real challenges. And I think if we understand the pathways through which those challenges operate, that it's mostly through the development of their stress response system, it gives us, gives teachers like your wife, or I think any educator, or really any policy person, any voter, any citizen, a new way of thinking about how to help children succeed. That a big part of what we need to do is to help improve children's early environments. And I think there are some parents who can do that alone, who can, you know, read my books and read other books and change the way that they are parenting. I think there are other parents who need additional help, especially parents who are living in poverty and experiencing all the stresses that go along with that. And so that's where I think policy comes into play. We need to create systems, and I write about some of them in Helping Children Succeed, some of the interventions that work. We need to create systems and interventions that can help support those parents one-on-one, like home visiting programs that go into homes and help parents change the dynamic between them and their children to increase that secure attachment, increase that serve and return parenting, diminish stress, diminish those sorts of stressful situations that kids can experience. That is actually not that hard for parents to do with the right kind of support. And when it happens, it has this profound effect on how children do, again, physically, as the ACEs study shows, but also in terms of their psychological and intellectual development.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. And I want to end on just one question here, and that is, For those that have listened, there's nuggets throughout that we've picked up, but if you could leave them with something, maybe it's new parents, maybe it's teachers, maybe it is policymakers, what's the one thing we can do to really help children succeed? I mean, if we can put something at the top, how would you round it out?
I think the thing that I think is most helpful to think about, whether you're a parent or a teacher or someone who's trying to shape policy, is that the environments that children grow up in are the most important thing for their development. And we can shape those environments. I think there's a danger when we just think about skills, whether it's cognitive skills or non-cognitive skills, is that it puts the pressure on the kids. You know, like these kids just have to somehow get these skills and they kind of need to figure them out for themselves. And our job is just to push them toward getting as many of those skills. But what this research that I write about in Helping Children Succeed suggests is that really our role as the adults who are surrounding kids, again, as teachers, parents, or policymakers, is to create environments where those kids will thrive. And the environments that work are environments where kids do feel a sense of relatedness and belonging, where they're not stressed out, where they're getting the right kind of stress, but not toxic levels of stress. And when they're experiencing real challenges, again, both in school and in the home. So the way that we challenge our kids and the way that we talk to them about what those challenges mean, those moments might seem really small in the home or in the school. But what the research suggests is that those are these profound moments, sometimes transformative moments for children, where they reevaluate and rethink who they are and what their job is as a kid and as a student. So we have an enormous amount of power, I think, to shape those environments, and we need to think carefully about how we're doing it.
Well, Paul, thank you so much. This really has been some great information. Again, the book is Helping Children Succeed: What Works and Why. Where else would you like to direct our listeners? I mean, do you write about this topic or others elsewhere if they're going, good, I need more?
Well, the place that I would direct them is to my website at paultuff.com. paultouch.com, which is paultouch.com. And if you go there now, with this new book, Helping Children Succeed, there is a web version. So there are links to buy the book, but there's also a web version where the contents of the book exist, but there are also links to some of the research I write about, videos that you can watch. Some of this information is in chart form and graph form as well. It's a really kind of interactive experience that supplements the book. So I would encourage readers to check that out if they're interested.
Great. Well, again, Paul, thank you so much for your time. I know you got another one coming up here in a few minutes, so I'm going to let you go. And look forward to getting this one live, and we'll let you know when it goes out there.
Great. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the conversation.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Paul Tough. Paul's book, Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why, can be found on Amazon and at your local bookstore. And if you do decide to purchase through Amazon, please do not forget to use the Smart People Podcast Amazon link located at smartpeoplepodcast.com/Amazon. When you do your shopping through smartpeoplepodcast.com/Amazon, it sends you over to Amazon as normal. You add the items to the cart, check out just as you normally would, and we get a nice little kickback from Amazon at no cost to you, and it truly is a huge help to the show. If you're looking for other free and easy ways to support the show, please head over to iTunes or Stitcher and leave a rating, review, and comment over there. I know we ask each and every week, but it is such a small thing that goes a long way for helping out the show. So if you could go ahead and leave a comment, rating, or review over at iTunes, we would be much appreciative of that. If you'd like to reach out to the show, please send us a message at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com or message us on Twitter at smartpeoplepod. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter yet, you can do so over at smartpeoplepodcast.com. We've always got great things coming out monthly in there. We'll let you know about any upcoming webinars, all kinds of good stuff. So head over to smartpeoplepodcast.com, sign up for the newsletter there. We've got some great interviews coming up, and we will see you all next week.